Welcome to part two of our continuing series entitled The Ticking of the Prophetic Clock. If you were not able to be here last week for part one, you will be at a disadvantage potentially for part two because they definitely build upon one another. I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour of what happened last week, and then we're going to launch into part two right away. Let me begin. This series of sermons is in response to a survey that I did in Andrews University Chapel asking students, what would you most like to hear preached about at Pioneer Memorial Church? And the top answer was Bible prophecy, how to understand it and how to help others understand it. This series is in response to that. Last week in part one, we dove right into it. We went to Revelation 12, 13, and 14, the very heart of why it was that the book of Revelation was written. We looked at a number of symbols there, and we also very quickly came to some principles of prophetic interpretation. Let me remind you what those were. Three of them last week. Number one, always study the context. If you don't know how to interpret a particular part of prophecy, study the culture and times in which it was written. And perhaps most importantly, study the surrounding verses, chapters, and read widely in the Bible. That led us to number two. Very often, the Bible interprets itself. If we are willing to do the work, get out a concordance, go online, search down the words associated with a prophetic symbol, etc., etc. Very often, the Bible interprets itself. And number three, Jesus is the center and ultimate interpreter of the Bible, including Bible prophecy. Bible prophecy is not given primarily to satisfy our curiosity about the future. It is most given that we might know Jesus Christ and help others to do the same. That is its ultimate purpose. We then begin to look at something called the unholy trinity. We zoomed out to 10,000 feet. Looking at our day, the last days of Earth's history, there are three players that are responsible for the mass deception, corruption, persecution, etc. around the planet. We looked at the first one. It was the dragon. This represented who? Satan, that's right. Revelation 12, 7, 8, 9, that process there describes very clearly it is Satan. We then looked at the beast out of the sea. Now, the dragon, we said, this is an imitation of God the Father. The beast out of the sea, we said, and we saw from the evidence there, is an imitation of Jesus Christ, God the Son. Well, how did we know that? Well, we looked at a number of characteristics of that sea beast. It has 10 horns and 7 heads, very much like the dragon in chapter 12. That blasphemy is a huge portion of the repertoire of the sea beast. It has characteristics of a bear, a leopard, and a lion. It gets its power, throne, and great authority from Satan, much like God the Father, the real God the Father, gave to his Son power and authority, Matthew 28, etc. So in the same way, the dragon gives the sea beast its power, throne, and great authority. It has a fatal wound that is healed. This is a clincher that indeed we are looking at the Antichrist power. You remember the prefix anti, yes, it means against, but literally it means in place of. And so the Antichrist is against Christ by seeking to take Christ's place, by seeking to take prerogatives that belong to Christ alone. And indeed, the sea beast has a fatal wound, one of its fatal wounds. It's crucified. That's what the language literally means there. And then it is healed. It rises from the grave. It is indeed an imitation of God the Son. It has authority for 42 months. It wars against God's people and conquers them, so it's a persecuting power. Verse 18, it has the number of a man, and at some point in the future, all those not belonging to Christ will worship the sea beast. Now, with that in mind, we have to know what this end time power is. The Antichrist power, this beast out of the sea, is not a minor player, a major player. That is what this is. And God did not put this verbiage here just so we could pass it by and go on to other things. We must know its identity. Now, to begin to find out that identity, we went back to Daniel chapter 2. In the Old Testament, in Daniel 2, in that chapter, a king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a multi-metaled statue. We learned that the head of gold represented the kingdom of Babylon. It was succeeded by the kingdom of Medo-Persia, represented by the arms and chest and arms of silver. It was knocked off by Greece, 331 BC, Alexander the Great. That was represented by the belly and thighs of brass. The legs of iron represented the empire of Rome, 168 to 476 AD. And the toes were a mixture of iron and clay. This represented the nations of Europe because the Empire of Rome did not fall to a single empire. Instead, there were roughly 10 tribes that became nations, most of them, that whittled away at Roman authority until finally 476 AD, the last vestige of genuine Roman power was destroyed. Now, At the end of that presentation, we asked who or what is the Antichrist of Revelation 13, and we were not yet there. That's what part two is for. Let's begin. Daniel chapter 7, please, verse 1. Turn in your Bibles, please. Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. It's page 601 in the Red Pew Bible that's somewhere near where you're sitting. Page 601, Daniel chapter 7, beginning with verse 1. While you are turning there, let me add another principle of prophetic interpretation. Number 4, pay careful attention to repetition and enlargement. Pay careful attention to repetition and enlargement. Excuse me, here's what that means. Many times, this is not an infrequent thing, God, in Bible prophecy, will inspire a certain symbol or theme to be talked about. And then later on, he will repeat that theme, but perhaps in a slightly different way, and he will enlarge upon it. He will give more details about it. So if you're puzzled about what a certain part of prophecy means, keep reading, because it may well be that God is going to repeat and enlarge on that particular theme. And indeed, scholars have long recognized. Daniel 2 is repeated and enlarged upon in Daniel 7 and in Daniel 8 and all the way up through Daniel 11. So we keep reading. This is, again, why it's important to read widely in the Word of God when you're seeking to interpret Bible prophecy. With that in mind, take a look at Daniel 7, beginning with verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. And visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea." Pause there, please. Now, let's make sure we understand the setting here. Belshazzar is now king of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is dead. He's passed off the scene. Belshazzar is most likely the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar through his mother, though we're not completely certain about that. This is about 50 years when this vision in Daniel 7 takes place after the vision in Daniel chapter 2. And this time around, instead of the king getting the vision, it's the prophet Daniel. And notice carefully, we're introduced to at least two more symbols here. There are four great beasts coming up out of the sea. Beasts and the sea. Notice what these two things mean, because the Bible interprets itself. If we were to read in Daniel 7, verse 17, an angel there gives this interpretation. It says, the four great beasts are for what? Kingdoms. Okay, very straightforward here. So immediately, our minds should be going back to Daniel chapter 2, because indeed, in Daniel chapter 2, we saw this very thing, a progression of four major world empires, chronologically going down from the time of Nebuchadnezzar on down through the ages, even down to the second coming, ultimately. And so we should be expecting that we will see the same progression of nations, shouldn't we? I mean, if it was right the first time, then it ought to be right the second time as well, not a whole different set of nations. How about the sea? Well, if we look at Revelation chapter 17, verse 15, we find the answer. The waters you saw are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. We still today have a saying. We say a sea of humanity, right? Like if you go to a football game or a parade or something like that, and there's all kinds of people, you look out, oh, it's a sea of humanity, right? Well, very similar thing here. In other words, what Daniel's vision contained are four kingdoms coming up out of great population centers. There's a lot of people here, languages, etc. This is where these nations are coming out of, not some barren place on the earth somewhere. Okay? And indeed, this is the case. Verse 4, please. The first beast, the first kingdom, was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. Now again, if we are consistent with Daniel chapter 2, we would expect that this first beast coming out of the sea is indeed commensurate to the head of gold, which was the nation of Babylon. And indeed, Babylon here is the correct interpretation. We know it not just because we would expect it from Daniel 2, but for at least three additional reasons. First of all, the lion was an extremely prominent symbol for the Neo-Babylonian Empire. What's the symbol for the United States of America? Yeah, the eagle, right? Okay, if you saw an eagle there, you know, flags on like wagon in the background, you would say United States. Well, in the same way, Daniel's immediately thinking, oh, this must be Babylon. On the screen here, this is a reconstruction of the Ishtar Gate. It's indoors, and that's because it's at the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, Germany. I've been to Germany, never been able to go to the museum. I want to go because I want to see the Ishtar Gate. The Ishtar Gate was commissioned by King Nebuchadnezzar, and it was extraordinarily beautiful. Nebuchadnezzar was a great developer and a builder. He commissioned the Ishtar Gate in honor of the goddess Ishtar, who was one of the main supposed patron gods of the Empire of Babylon. The Ishtar Gate was the beginning of what was known as the processional way. And just think of it as a place for processions, for parades, for big occasions, this kind of a thing. It stretched more than 800 meters north of the Ishtar Gate. And one of the symbols of Ishtar was the lion. And that's why on the processional way, there were 120 of these reliefs. Of the lions there, 60 on either side. And so again, when Daniel sees this in vision, I mean, immediately goes, oh, this is Babylon, right? Second, the Bible explicitly refers to Babylon as a lion and or having eagle's wings. For instance, Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 7. God is speaking here. He says, a lion has come out of his lair. A destroyer of nations has set out. He has left his place to lay waste your land. Your towns will lie in ruins without inhabitant. And clearly the context is referring to the Babylonian Empire. We could also see texts like Jeremiah 50, verses 17 and 44, Lamentations 4, 19, Ezekiel 17, 3, and verse 12. And all of these, again, are dealing particularly with the invasion of Judah and Israel by the Babylonians. And a third way that we know that this beast is indeed the Babylonian nation is that the rest of the prophecy works flawlessly when we start with Babylon. No other nation starts the progression in a cohesive way. Look at verse 5, please. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. Now, here's an artist's representation of what that might have looked like here. And indeed, you see this bear here. It's an excellent symbol of the Medo-Persian Empire. It's raised up on one side, okay? And almost certainly the reason for that is that the Persians, they were in with the Medes. That's why it's known as the Medo-Persian Empire. But the Persians were definitely the stronger partner, thus the raised shoulder. The three ribs in its mouth. You know, when a bear gets something in its mouth to consume it, that's its prey, right? It is preyed, P-R-E-Y-E-D, on whatever the hapless creature is, right? And so the prey of the Medo-Persian Empire is in its mouth here. Well, sure enough, on its way to becoming a world-class empire, the Medo-Persians took off the Babylonians, Lydia, and Egypt. Three empires symbolized by these three ribs in its mouth. Again, the parallels between this and Daniel chapter 2, chest and arms of silver, this bear raised up one side, three ribs in its mouth. These two things are parallel in these two visions. God is repeating himself and enlarging upon the theme. Let's continue. Verse 6. After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. Now, what nation, based on Daniel chapter 2, should we be expecting next? Okay, Greece is right, okay? And indeed, the parallels here are very strong. This is a fitting symbol for it. You know, a leopard with four heads and a double set of wings would immediately call to mind anybody who had been at the pointy end of Alexander the Great's spear. The double wings almost certainly represent tremendous speed because Alexander was able to take his armies. Scholars to this day are in awe. He moved essentially all the way across Asia with thousands, tens of thousands of his soldiers and decimated everyone in his path with the speeds of his army. The four heads of this leopard-like beast are also true to history. After the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, the empire eventually came to be divided among his top generals, and this led to the empire being divided into four separate areas under these four generals. Cassander was over Macedonia and territorial Greece. Lysimachus was over Asia Minor and Thrace. Ptolemy was over Egypt, and Seleucus was over the east and Syria. A very fitting image given here for the empire that was Greece. And then we come to the fourth beast, which, if the pattern is correct, should be Rome. That's right. Let's take a peek here and see if we find any similarities between this and Daniel 2. Verse 7, after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Well, let's see if we can find some parallels here. The legs in the vision of Daniel chapter 2 that represented Rome were made of iron. That's right, iron. Very hard metal here. And indeed, once again, this metal iron is prominent in Daniel 7's vision of Rome, this time in the form of iron teeth. You know, it crushes its victims, right? And indeed, Rome ruled with an iron grip, and it did this for centuries, seemingly without mercy on its opponents. And as I asked in part one, let me ask again, how many toes do most people have? 10, okay, most people, you know, give or take a few. Again, we welcome those of you with 9 and 11. You're fine. You're right here in your right place, okay? 10 more or less. And indeed, as we pointed out in part one, that is the approximate number of tribes that ultimately whittled away at Rome, overcame it, and it's symbolized here by the 10 toes in Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue. We also talked about how it was that most of those 10 toes eventually became the nations of Europe that we know today, of Western Europe. Now, the Lombards became the Italians, the Burgundians became the Swiss, the Franks became the French, etc., etc. But we also pointed out that there were 3 of those approximate 10 that are no longer with us today. Those are the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. Today, they are extinct. And it turns out that Daniel 7 catches this as well. In Daniel 7, instead of having 10 toes as in Daniel 2, now we have 10 horns. And notice carefully what the text says next. Verse 8, please. Daniel speaking, he says, while I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. That's interesting. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. Now, pause for just a moment. Daniel here wants to know the interpretation, particularly of this part of the vision. If we were to keep reading here in Daniel chapter 7, yes, he's concerned about the first 3 beasts, etc. But the fourth one, that really has his attention. And the little horn definitely has his attention. There's something there, he can't figure it out. So, he asks one of the angels that are nearby for help. Skip down to verse 21, please. Daniel here still speaking. He says, as I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. Verse 23, he, meaning this angel, gave me this explanation, quote, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise. This is the little horn. Different from the earlier ones, he will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. And now, brothers and sisters, we are very close. We nearly have all the information that we need to identify the Antichrist, that is, the sea beast of Revelation 13. And some of you might be thinking, well, we haven't been talking about that. We've been talking about this little horn power. Well, let me just put this on the screen so that we are all very clearly on the same page. The little horn of Daniel 7 and the sea beast of Revelation 13 are one and the same. They are the same entity. They refer to the same thing. Now, why do I say that? Because there are very strong similarities between the little horn of Daniel 7 and the sea beast of Revelation 13. Let me just put some of the similarities here up on the screen. First of all, here we have eyes of a man. The little horn of Daniel 7 is said to have eyes of a man. The sea beast is said to have the number of a man. By the way, these verses in the parentheses here, verse 8 is in Daniel 7, verse 18 is in Revelation 13, and so on and so forth for the remainder of this chart. Eyes of a man, number of a man. There's some, you know, what exactly does this mean? We're not entirely sure, but clearly there is a pronounced human element in these two entities, a pronounced human element. And really, of course, it's one entity. The little horn of Daniel 7 follows a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a nondescript beast. In Revelation 13, the sea beast has characteristics of a lion, a bear, a leopard, and it follows after a dragon. In other words, any self-respecting Jew or somebody who familiar with Jewish apocalyptic in the first century when Revelation 13 was written, when they came to Revelation 13, verse 2, and it said it has characteristics of a lion, bear, leopard, oh, wait a second, that's Daniel chapter 7. The little horn in Daniel 7 makes war with the saints. The sea beast does the same, almost nearly identical verbiage. It speaks boastfully, the little horn in Daniel 7, against the Most High. The sea beast speaks blasphemy against God. Again, very similar verbiage, but what makes the tie complete is this. The little horn rules for a time, times, and half a time, which equals 1,260 days, and the sea beast rules for 42 months, which also equals 1,260 days. And right now, some of you are saying, how did you come up with that? Now, I'm not the world's greatest mathematician, but I do know this part of prophecy decently, so let me explain. In Daniel chapter 7, when it says that the little horn power will rule for a time, times, and half a time, you must remember that this is written in Aramaic. From almost the beginning of chapter 2 all the way through the end of Daniel chapter 7, it's written not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. The two languages have a lot of similarities, but this is Aramaic, and that's important because of the interpretation. The word that we interpret as time is actually the word for year, and it's singular. If you want proof of this, you can go back to Daniel chapter 4. Many of your translations will actually note this in the footnotes. Okay? A time equals a year. Times, you know, if we put an S on the end of something, okay, so if I say that I have $100 bills in my pocket right now, it could be any number of $100 bills because that S is, you know, it's indefinite. Not so with this particular Aramaic word. This is the Aramaic dual, D-U-A-L. It means two and only 2 years. Half a time, well, that's half a year. Jewish prophetic reckoning for a year had 360 days. So let's do the math. 1 year, 360 days. 2 years, 720 days. Half a year, 180 days. You add all those together and you get 1,260, exactly. So it rules for 1,260 days, and so does the sea beast. How do I know? In a Jewish prophetic month, there are 30 days. 42 times 30 is 1,260. They rule initially for the very same length of time. These are the same powers. It's talking about one. This time element brings us to a fifth and very important principle of prophetic interpretation. As a general rule in Bible prophecy, a prophetic day equals one literal year. As a general rule in Bible prophecy, a prophetic day equals one literal year. How do we know this? Well, let's take a peek. Numbers chapter 14, verse 34. God here is chastising the Israelites because they have, because of their faithlessness, they have refused to enter into the land of Canaan the first time around. God is now pronouncing sentence. He is prophesying about the future for Israel. He says, according to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year. How many years did they wander in the desert? 40, exactly. A day for a year, God is prophesying this. We have another example. Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. God here is speaking to his prophet. So it's another prophetic scenario. The prophet Ezekiel, he says, lie down again, Ezekiel, this time on your right side, and bear the sin of the house of Judah. I have assigned you 40 days, a day for each year. So this day for a year principle, it is found here in Scripture, and it works marvelously. I'll just be blunt with you. If you have 1,260 literal days and you try to interpret this prophecy that way, it doesn't make any sense. There's nothing there that fits that description at all. But when we use the day for a year principle, aha, it works very well, as you will soon see. But first, let's revise our last slide. The little horn and the sea beast both have their initial period of time of ruling that equals 1,260 years. And do you see what this means? What this means is that if we take these clues together that we've seen on that chart, if we can identify the little horn of Daniel 7 accurately, then we can also identify the sea beast of Revelation 13, the end time Antichrist power. So can we identify this little horn? Indeed, we can, and we don't have to guess. I'm going to put up here on the screen nine characteristics that the text has given us for the identity of the little horn power. Number one, it arises out of Western Europe. I hope this makes sense to you by now. We know this because it says the little horn came up among those 10 kings. We know those to be the nations of Western Europe. So it comes up among them. This is a geographical clue, okay? Number two, it starts as a little horn, in other words, a little kingdom. It's not a lumbering Alexander the Great with tens of thousands of soldiers. It starts small and then becomes big. Number three, it rises from the ruins of the Roman Empire after 476 AD. How do we know that? Because the last vestige of any substance of Rome was defeated in 476 AD. The little horn comes up after that. Between the first clue and the third one, geography and chronology, you probably ought to be able to come pretty close to already identifying the little horn power. Number four, the Heruli, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths are uprooted before it. In other words, before this little horn comes to power, these three have to be swept out of the way. If we can find out what power rose to prominence after that time, we can find the little horn. Number five, it speaks boastfully, blasphemous words against God. Number six, it is different from the other beasts. In other words, different from the other kingdoms. You know, every kingdom is different in little ways from one kingdom to the next, so this needs to be something that's major, all right? Number seven, tries to change God's laws. Daniel 7, verse 25. Now, some people at first glance will say, well, wait a second. It just says it would think to change times and laws. I mean, that could be anybody's times and laws. No. Human laws change all the time. Our times change all the time. I mean, have you heard of Congress? I mean, stuff changes, right? There's confusion, and, you know, it changes. Today alone, there are probably a dozen countries that are changing their laws right now, right? And so it can't be referring to that because that has no prophetic significance. But God's laws, that's very significant. And it's clearly the implication here. Number eight, it is a persecuting power. And number nine, it would initially rule for 1,260 years. Nine characteristics. Now, let me ask you something. Did I make these up? No. There's a reason that I put the verses next to each one of these. If you want to look these up, please do. Please make a beeline for Daniel. Read these things yourself. This is God talking. It's not me, not anybody else. God has inspired this to be written, these nine clues. And with those clues in mind, let me be clear. There is one and only one power in human history that fits all nine of these characteristics. And that one power is the Roman Catholic Church. There is no other. Honestly, there's not even anything that comes close. You might be able to find the nation that kind of fits, you know, one or two, one of the other things there, but all nine, no, not even close. There's just one. And God did not intend for us to have to guess. Now, this is a picture of St. Peter's Square. I've been there a number of times. It's obviously not a square. This is from the air. It's a keyhole. Catholic theology teaches that the Catholic Church began when Christ supposedly gave Peter the keys to the kingdom. It's an incorrect understanding of the verse, but that is where they start their roots from. And so this is a giant keyhole there at the Vatican. You'll notice that I didn't say that the little horn power is Roman Catholics. We're talking about the organization here. And many times you know full well that there can be a profound difference between the members of an organization and the organization itself. Is that true? It is true, isn't it? We're going to talk more about that in just a moment here. But first, let's go back and look through the clues to make sure that we have made a proper identification. Number one, prophecy said, it will arise out of Western Europe. Indeed, this is very true for the papacy. I mean, Rome, Italy, it's right smack there amongst the nations of Western Europe. Number two, it starts as a little horn or a little kingdom. Indeed, that is true. The papacy started out relatively small. It was only in the 6th century that we see this tremendous rise to become a global class power. Number three, it rises from the ruins of the Roman Empire after 476 AD. Now, some have quibbled with this a little bit, and they don't draw a connection between pagan Rome and papal Rome. I would just humbly suggest that almost all of scholardom disagrees with you, because the evidence is abundant. Papal Rome was indeed built on the ashes of pagan Rome. Much of pagan Rome's political functions, its leadership titles, its language, namely Latin, and its methods of organization were simply adopted by the Roman Church as their own. Let me just give you some examples here. German author von Dollinger wrote the following quotation when he was a Catholic priest, a theologian, and a historian. He said this. He said, "Out of the chaos of the great northern migrations and the ruins of the Roman Empire, there gradually rose a new order of states whose central point was the papal see." A contemporary of von Dollinger was Arthur Stanley. He was an English Anglican priest, theologian, and historian, and he described the papacy's rise like this. He said, "As the Pope filled the place of the absent emperors at Rome, he was inheriting their power, their prestige, the titles which they themselves had derived from paganism." Now, if you go to St. Peter's, you'll see Pontifex Maximus written in Latin there. And that is a title that was formerly used by the pagan Roman emperors. But now it refers to the Pope. And there are multiple examples of this type of carryover from the pagan Roman Empire. Number four, the Heruli, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths are uprooted before it. This is a simple fact of history. The papacy at this time did not have its own armies at its disposal, but it did have a chap by the name of Justinian. Emperor Justinian declared in the early 530s that the Pope was the head of all Christianity, and gradually began to lend his forces to defeat the Arian tribes, which were theologically very much against the papacy. The final decisive blow against the last of those three tribes, the Ostrogoths, was dealt in 538 AD. What year did I say? 538 AD. Keep that in mind, please. Number five, it speaks boastfully and blasphemous words against God. I want to be clear, it brings me no pleasure to put on the screen here what I'm going to put up next. There's no joy in this for me, but it is a fact of history and of the present that indeed the Roman Church organization has committed this sin. A guy by the name of Lucius Ferraris, wrote Prompta Bibliotheca. It was first published in 1746. It's a renowned multi-volume Latin encyclopedia of Catholic canon law, theology, and morality. Prompta Bibliotheca, this means like a handy library, you know, quick reference library type this. So this is a Catholic theologian who is writing this. Volume 6, pages 25 to 29, contains the following distillation here in the article entitled Papa in the Latin, or Pope here. "The Pope is of so great dignity and so exalted that he is not a mere man, but as it were, God, and the vicar of God. The Pope is called most holy because he is rightfully presumed to be such. He is likewise the divine monarch and the supreme emperor and king of kings." Ladies and gentlemen, that's blasphemy. Those titles belong to God and God alone. No human being can take those on themselves. The Pope is, as it were, God on earth, sole sovereign of the faithful of Christ, chief king of kings, having plenitude of power. Now some say, well, that was just a single man, and that was a long time ago. Okay, all right, fine. Let's continue briefly down, a very brief tour of history here on this particular topic of papal authority. The First Vatican Council took place in 1869 to 1870. Now, this is an ecumenical council. Don't be fooled by the title. This is not the first ecumenical council. This is simply the First Vatican Council, the location there, again, in 1869 to 1870. Now, you must understand something. The 21 ecumenical councils of the Catholic Church are serious business. This is not like if a council issues a statement, a decree on faith or morals, this is not a suggestion. This is law, and it has that force. I have here a copy here at great expense. These books are not cheap. All of the 21 ecumenical councils in Latin and in English. I confess my Latin is poor, but my English is pretty good, and I've spent a fair amount of time reading. I have not read them all, but I have read quite a bit. And it's in these councils that if you want to know what it is that the Roman Catholic organization stands for, one of the good places to go is right there at those councils' decrees. They are infallible when they are spoken with this force on faith and morals, okay? Considered infallible, at least, I should say. First dogmatic constitution on the Church of Christ, chapter 3. The Roman pontiff is the head of the whole church and father and teacher of all Christian people. That includes everyone right now listening to my voice who calls themselves a Christian. That's the claim, at least. The Roman church possesses a preeminence of ordinary power over every other church. Both clergy and faithful are bound to submit to this power. In this way, by unity with the Roman pontiff in communion and in profession of the same faith, the Church of Christ becomes one flock under one supreme shepherd, and that's not Jesus. So then, if anyone says that the Roman pontiff has merely an office of supervision and guidance, time out for just a moment. There are many Catholics in this country that make this claim. Nominal Catholicism is a big problem in the Catholic Church. The Catholics not taking Catholicism seriously. There's many of them that are saying this, and there's many Adventists today that are saying this, okay? Oh, he's just, you know, it's just a nice role, and it gives guidance and encouragement and whatnot there. Well, do you understand what the official dogma of the Catholic Church says about that attitude? If anyone says that the Roman pontiff has merely an office of supervision and guidance and not the full and supreme power of jurisdiction of the whole church, or that this power of his is not ordinary and immediate, both over all and each of the churches and over all and each of the pastors and faithful, let him be anathema. Now, anathema means something very specific. Some have immediately jumped and said, well, that means that the Catholic Church is saying if you don't accept the Pope as the infallible leader of your soul and determining what happens with your destiny, then you are condemned to burn forever and ever in the fires of hell. Catholic scholars will rightly come back and they will say, no, that's not what anathema means. If you are declared anathema by the church, what that means is that you are put outside of the church and you can no longer take part in the sacraments of the church. Here's what you need to remember. The Catholic Church, official dogma, official teaching is that the grace of Jesus Christ comes through the sacraments of the church. No sacraments, no salvation, and you burn in the fires of hell forever and ever. So it is a distinction that my Catholic theologian friends make without a difference. The end result is the same. Now, the Bible does not teach that there is an everlasting hell that burns forever and ever. Catholic teaching does teach that. Much of Christianity teaches that. It's not true. But this is what official Catholic teaching says if you do not accept the Pope and the Council's decrees as infallible and the rule for your life. These are prerogatives that belong to God alone. They do not belong to a church, an organization, or any human being. And just in case we think this is an ancient thing, Second Vatican Council, 1962 to 1965, again, dogmatic constitution on the Church of Christ, section 25, therefore the Pope's definitions, that is, his teachings on faith and morals, are rightly said to be irreformable, and therefore they have no need of approval from others, nor do they admit any appeal to any other judgment. All are obliged to abide, and all must conform to his decrees. I do not conform to the decrees of a human being. I conform to the decrees of Jesus Christ. And lastly, Catechism of the Catholic Church. I brought my catechism with me here. I have a couple of these. I believe it's the most recent one. You can get this on Amazon today. It has the imprimatur of the church in the front. This is official Catholic teaching. A catechism is what you go through before you become an official member of the Catholic Church. So this is the real deal. This is here. Just two sections. Section 937. Says the Pope enjoys by divine institution supreme. What word is that again? Supreme. What does that mean? Ultimate, total, right, over anyone else, okay? Supreme, full, immediate, and universal power in the care of souls. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, that's Jesus Christ, not a Pope. That's not a human being, that's Jesus. One other section here, section 891. The Roman pontiff, head of the College of Bishops, enjoys this infallibility. So again, the claim of being infallible
When he proclaims by a definitive act a doctrine pertaining to faith or morals, these definitions must be adhered to. And that includes you, so they say. Sadly, this charge of blasphemy and boastfulness is true. Number six, different from the other beasts, different from the other kingdoms. There's more than one way to interpret this characteristic, but surely one of the most obvious is this. All of the other earthly kingdoms of Daniel 7 were ruled by military leaders or politicians who may secondarily have had a religious role in the nation. But the papacy is a church that rules. Church and state are combined with the church at the head and the state serving it. It is first and foremost a religious entity that then claims authority over political and military affairs on a global scale. That indeed is profoundly different from the other kingdoms in Daniel chapter 7. Number seven, tries to change God's laws. Now we're going to talk more about this later on, sometime before graduation, but for now note just the following example. Again, from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, this is from the introduction between sections 2167 and 2168. By the way, I realize that is not the appropriate scholarly way to reference the Catechism. I say it this way because it's the easiest way to navigate it. If you've never seen a Catechism and you pull one out, like, oh, where is this, where is this? If you just follow the section numbers, you'll be fine. You'll find this spot. That's why I do it that way. Quoting now from the introduction there, Article 3, the third commandment, and then it quotes, quote, the third commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Is that the third commandment? No, that's the fourth commandment, isn't it? So already we can tell that there's something that's off here where they've attempted a change to God's law. Section 2177, emphasis here is mine. The emphasis, the colors are not in the catechism. The Sunday celebration of the Lord's Day and His Eucharist is at the heart of the church's life. This is their claim. Sunday is the day on which the Paschal Mystery is celebrated in light of the apostolic tradition and is to be observed as the foremost holy day of obligation in the universal church. In other words, the seventh day Sabbath, the one and only true holy Sabbath, from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, from Scripture, is not the holy day of God. It is superseded, they say, by a day of man's creation. Indeed, they have attempted to change God's law. More about that in the future. Number eight, a persecuting power. Sadly, this is also true. Conservative estimates start at 20 million people that were killed during the Dark Ages, there at the apogee of the Roman Catholic Church's 1,260 years, during the Inquisitions mostly. Now, to be fair, in the year 2000, Pope John Paul II did the right thing and issued an official apology for all of those deaths. So I mention this not to reignite an old argument, but simply to point out that this characteristic of being a persecuting power most definitely fits the Roman Catholic Church. And lastly, number nine, it would initially rule for 1,260 years. Let me just put a simple timeline up here on the screen for you. 538 AD, with Emperor Justinian's forces' help, the final death blow is given to the Ostrogoths. From that time forward, for 1,260 years, papal supremacy was generally the order of the day. Now, there was ebbing and flowing of the papacy's power, there's no doubt about that, but it rose from being relatively insignificant as far as a global power to being a global power, no doubt about it. At the end of the 1700s, careful Bible students began to get the word out. Hey, the prophecy says that at the end of the 1260 years, because the little horn and Revelation 13 sea beast, they're the same, pay attention because a deadly wound is coming. It's going to be healed, but the deadly wound is coming. Watch out, watch out. And sure enough, 1798, right on time, Napoleon sends his general Berthier into Rome, takes the Pope captive. The Pope is exiled to the island of Elba, where he later dies in exile. And indeed, while the papacy had been on a decline, I mean, that's how Napoleon could overcome them, that marked a deadly wound, and the end of the 1260 years had come, just as Daniel and John had predicted. Indeed, the Roman Catholic organization fits each of these nine identifying characteristics. No one else even comes close. It is the little horn power of Daniel 7, and it is the end time Antichrist power of Revelation 13. Let me leave you with two things. We have now correctly identified two out of the three members of the unholy Trinity. We have the imitation of God the Father, Satan, as the dragon. We have the imitation of God the Son, papacy, as this beast out of the sea. There is a third member, obviously, of this Trinity. And if you would like to know who this is, come back the last Sabbath of this month. We're going to have a little break here, okay? We've got some special things coming next Sabbath. You're not going to want to miss it. Elder Mike Ryan is going to be here doing a special presentation on Revelation Bible prophecy. If you've never seen it before, you need to be here. It's going to be good. And at the end of the month, we are going to talk and reveal what the identity of this third member of the unholy Trinity is. If you have not studied this and you do not yet know who that third member of the unholy Trinity is, it is startling. And I hope that you can be here. And lastly, do not walk out of this room without understanding something very, very clearly. And that is this: Jesus Christ loves and respects Catholics. And so should you. This is not a time to be bashing our faithful brothers and sisters in Christ. You see, on that morning, symbolized here, you know, when Jesus comes, you know, and the graves open up and the saints rise to meet him in the air, there will be, there'll be a large number, millions upon millions of Roman Catholics will be there that day. And you say, well, how can you say that? Well, we've got some pretty good clues here. Ellen White, true prophet of God and one of the founders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, had this to say. She said, notwithstanding the spiritual darkness and alienation from God that exist in the churches which constitute Babylon, this is spiritual Babylon at the end of time, the great body of Christ's true followers are still to be found in their communion. In other words, there's more of them than there are of us. There's more true believers in God inside of spiritual Babylon than there are outside of it. There are faithful people living up to the light that they have. They're being faithful to all that they know. And when they hear the truth for this time, they will make a decision to follow Jesus all the way. And until that time, don't be throwing stones. Don't be throwing rocks, okay? Let me just be blunt. Don't be a jerk. All right? Don't be a jerk. Treat them as Jesus would if he were in your shoes. Love them, be respectful, be kind. In fact, if you need a reminder from Jesus himself, Revelation chapter 18, verse 4, Jesus says, speaking of spiritual Babylon, come out of her, my people. My people. You know, Catholics do wonderful things the world over. They're my neighbors and your neighbors. For many of you, they're your family members. These are good people. They are living up to the best light that they have. This is not a call to bash Catholics. This is a call instead from Christ to Christ and to his word. A call to renew our study of that word that we might all truly know how to rightly divide it and to see Jesus in all of his truth, his grace, and his love. May God guide our Catholic brothers and sisters who are faithful to Jesus Christ. May God guide all the rest of us who are equally prone to error and pride. And may all of us be ready for Christ's soon return.